Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and today my guest is Matthew Clam. His new book is Who is Rich? His last book was approximately 16 years ago. It was called Sam the Cat. It was a book of stories. It was very, very, very well admired, very funny. I found Who Was Rich, although it has been described as a satire, a book that was full of sadness and loss and the sense that over these last 16 years, fiction has become something other than it was when Sam the Cat was published. Tell me, how does a novel take 16 years to write?
Well, thanks for having me on the show.
It's a pleasure.
I began writing the book in January of 2010. So it was about 6.5 years that it took to write it. And in between then, I was a magazine journalist for years, and I wrote cover stories for the New York Times, Mag, GQ, Esquire, Harper's, and McSweeney's, and got to travel and meet celebs and do other things like that, and write about the Navy and U.S. military foreign policy and Wall Street. But I needed some time. I needed time, and I also had the feeling that I needed to do more than just write a really good short story. And I also realized at a certain point that I didn't want to write another short story, and I didn't know how to do something bigger. And so I needed to kind of build up some steam. I think the elements that are present in this story, you know, there's some of this kind of midlife alienation. There's issues of domestic entanglement, you know, marriage and mortgage and parenting, being involved in the world as a working person, being committed and being in that feeling that pressure of knowing that you can't die because you have to support your kids. And I admired novels. I'd been, you know, amazed by great novel writing, and it seemed so big and so powerfully interlocked, the pieces of a good novel. And I just was, I wanted to write one. Anyway, it took a while for me to fess up to my ambition.
The hero of Who Is Rich is Richard Fisher. He's a graphic novelist of autobiographical background, and he too has taken years since his last book to publish a new one.
I think it's about six, something like that. It's 6 or 7 years since his last book. It's not quite as long.
And his book has gone out of print.
Yeah.
In the interim.
Yeah.
And it was a kind of special book because people liked the fact that this graphic novel was so personal.
Mm.
And now here he is starting again.
Mm.
He doesn't know how to start.
Yeah.
He's had an affair.
Mm.
He's at a summer writing conference.
Mm-hmm.
Nowadays, summer writing conferences might very well be summer graphic novel writing conferences.
Sure.
We've got a lot of new kinds of writing that are involved.
Yeah.
So tell me, how autobiographical is this? I mean, it felt like a book that really knew its turf because it was your turf.
Yeah, you know, I think it's inevitable that when you write in the first person, readers will assume that the narrator is you and that the material is true.
Is it?
And and while I draw off of not just my own personal experiences, but the sort of treasure trove of literature that I've read, things I've witnessed, I happen to have a face that people tell things to. People seem to reveal a lot of things to me. It's, you know, it's of course an amalgam of my own experiences and the narrative demands of making a story. And this is something that I wanted to deal with in the book, and it's why my narrator is teaching a class called Semi-Autobiographical Comics. To me, it's absurd because I'm a person who draws off of material that I've witnessed when I write fiction. It's absurd for me to pretend otherwise. And I think one of the things that I was trying to do in there was draw the reader into some of the immediacy of writing a piece of fiction when one is struggling to get in touch with the various influences that one uses that when one's writing. And I thought, let's just go ahead and say it, you know, that this has semi-autobiographical elements.
This is a man who is in the middle of an extramarital affair. Mm. He's come back to the writing workshop, hoping that the woman he met the year before will be there again.
Yeah.
She is there. She hasn't made it clear to him that she will be there. Mm. There's a certain kind of sense as we go on reading this book that she is there and she's not there.
Yeah.
His wife is and isn't his wife. There's this painful relationship. And although, as I said before, the book has been described as satire, I took it to be, autobiographical or not, an enormously painful book that had some sort of relation to truth-telling. I wondered whether this made it still harder to write.
Yeah, you know, I am someone who every piece of fiction I've ever written has been about transgressive sex, so it was inevitable that that was probably going to be an element. In this book, I am also someone who is in love with the idea of love. And I think that that is something I've struggled with since I was a kid. And as anyone knows who's been in a relationship for longer than 3 months, the kind of romantic notions, you know, begin to fall away. And what we have in this couple is, you know, these people married for, they've been together for 11 or 12 years. They have a child who's one and isn't sleeping. And according to the narrator, hasn't slept more than 2 hours straight in his whole life. And he's not the most reliable narrator, but he is sort of trying to report to you on the struggles in their home. I tried as much as I could to kind of infuse those descriptions of the domestic life between them with this kind of cosmic gale of laughter. Maybe it comes off as sad, but also I'm hoping, you know, a sort of feeling of recognition and a kind of cosmic laughter comes to people who are reading this, who recognize it and identify with it. But yeah, certainly there's sadness. I mean, the narrator is, you know, he's up against the wall. He's trying to figure out how he's going to enter into the next phase of his professional life. He considers himself an artist, but he's not making art. His wife used to be a wartime TV journalist. She has now taken a job in a place that she describes. It's a place that makes nature documentaries and nature television, as like having the atmosphere of a shoe store. His love interest, Amy, is the wife of a billionaire and is herself in charge of terrific philanthropic projects. But while she's sitting on top of this mountain of cash, she's ignored by her husband and worse, and is unloved and feels shock at how her life has turned out.
I'm talking to Matthew Clam about his book, Who is Rich? And the question is, who is rich? There's a character named Rich Fisher who really may not know who he is. There is a very rich woman in the book, and yet she can't really give a gift. She gives cheap little trinkets, while he gives her things that are way too expensive. In fact, he gives her a gift that was meant for his wife, an expensive gift, a gift that his wife would have found expensive, but that this billionaire's wife can yodel at. You know, it's just not anything.
It's funny that you say that. I hadn't really thought of it that way. Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
And what's very moving here is that here we have, what do you want to call it? Certainly it's one of the circles of hell. The writing program that people are teaching at who no longer write, and people who are studying at who are not sure they can write. They're looking to teachers who may not be able to help them. What? It's the parable of life when it stops being full of surprises, revelations, and satisfactions, and instead you find yourself wondering, well, to what degree am I a failure? What is the nature of my failure? And a lot of the people who come to this writing program have been there year after year. They come back again, they come back again, and each time they come back, perhaps they're a little further down in another circle of hell. I thought I'd ask you to read a little section. Let's hear.
This is just at the beginning, this is page 4. Nada Klein, with her long French braid and dark wolfish eyes, walked through the tent with her shawl dragging on the ground. She beat cancer every year and showed up late to her own slide talks and was widely mocked and imitated. Larry Burris was back, too. He skipped his meds one year and wore a jester's cap to class and lit his own notes on fire and had to spend the night in a hospital. He stood beside me now, beneath the tent flap, patiently signing a copy of his book and handed it back to a woman who hugged him. On the faculty were many friends I'd come to know over the years as intellects, historians, wordsmiths, talented performers, storytellers with big fake teeth, addicts, drunkards, perverts, world-famous womanizers, sufferers of gout, maniacs, liars, embittered, delusional, accomplished, scared of spiders, unable to swim, loveless, and cruel. I noticed Barney Angerman, who'd won the Pulitzer for drama the year I was born, and Tabitha Portenlee, who'd written an acclaimed incest memoir. She was helping Barney through the breakfast line as he gripped her arm. This past winter, the conference director had asked me to name another cartoonist I could vouch for to teach a second comics workshop, but I didn't answer him. I worried, because of the way my career had gone, that I'd be hiring my replacement. A little before 9, I went to the Fine Arts Building. Hurrying down a long hall, past students and teachers, I looked for my studio. There were classes in the annex now, landscape photography, felt making, fresco on plaster, whatever that was. When I got there, they were pulling out their stuff, giving each other the once-over. I flipped through my notes. A woman who lived in town was complaining about beach traffic. A skinny kid stared at me, wearing a sundress, mascara, and a pearl choker. A young Asian woman stared at him, clutching her pencil case, a young man in a white polo, a craggy-looking old guy, and a girl with button eyes and tiny feet were talking with affection about their dogs. I opened the info packet and read the bios of other teachers and guest speakers printed in the conference pamphlet. There were different levels of us, unknown nobodies and one-hit has-beens, midlist somebodies and legitimate stars. As I read, I could hear my own labored breathing. I tried to slow it down, but felt worse, graying as the blood left my brain. I read my course description from who knows when.
Matthew Clam, reading from Who Is Rich? And I think, you know, when we come to these different levels of us, unknown nobodies and one-hit has-beens, midlist somebodies and legitimate stars, isn't it the hardest thing of all to want to be an artist, to want to be a writer, to be stuck in the realm where other people are determining who and what you are, what your abilities are, whether you've succeeded in batting it out of the park this time, or...
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think on closer inspection, you know, and so teaching at Johns Hopkins, you know, all kinds of the most famous writers who are alive right now have visited and given readings there. And I know some and met and encountered these people over the years. I gave, you know, a reading with Jonathan Franzen 1 year at a New Yorker event. I gave a reading with Stephen King 1 year. On close inspection, it's a little bit silly because it's inevitable that in any given year, a really famous writer is going to publish something that to universal acclaim that when you look at it, it's not a good book. And at the same time, absolutely amazing stuff can't even find a publisher, and then it finally does, and then you realize it's fantastic. And so the mechanism that kind of pumps this stuff out into the world is not dependable. And so for those of us who've been a part of it and also, you know, some written reviews or whatever, have friends, watch them go up or down, I think we have the ability to take it a little less seriously. But, you know, he's feeling that it is quite serious because he's on the outside looking in. I think one of the things that's happening as you're reading the book is that you're rooting for this guy to create a piece of art. And if you like the book and you continue on, you realize you're actually holding it in your hands.
Yes.
Whether they're talented or untalented, I mean, there are talented artists in that class, but he has a sinking feeling that he's not going to be able to take them to that next magical stage in their career. And he also has a few students in the class who he hates, who he doesn't think have any talent at all.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Matthew Klam about his book, Who is Rich? That's K-L-A-M. I'm sure that you'll want to look it up, and it's not with a C, and it's only with one M. We'll continue after this short break.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Matthew Klam about his latest book, Who is Rich? Where escaping to a New England beachside town doesn't lead to rest, but to an internal struggle over questions of love and family and talent and ability. And you see, I have the feeling, Matthew, that this book would not have been the same book some years ago. Some years ago, writers who wanted to be writers, who were taking workshops, who were going to workshops, who were finding their way to Iowa or something in Saratoga Springs or working with interesting writers, were going to have that relationship follow them year after year. They'd be helped. Someone would recommend an editor, a publisher. I think this is part of the world we're living in, where writing and reading are being performed for lower and lower stakes now. Do you feel, when you were studying writing at Hollins, did it feel hopeless like this? Because this is a very sad book.
I think there is a way to look at the struggle of these artists as sad, but I did, you know, I when I was a grad student, I just was there for 9 months. It wasn't long enough to ruin my life, but I know, you know, like David Foster Wallace loved making fun of the sort of the heaviness of an MFA student. I just was, you know, at Johns Hopkins for the last 8 years, and there's a graduate degree in poetry, and there are undergraduates who come and study for 4 years in the writing seminars, and they're, I don't think they think of the literary world as diminished at all. I think it's very alive for them, and I think it's, in a way, always been something a little bit outside of, you know, capitalism. And, you know, I mean, F. Scott Fitzgerald came out to Hollywood and had his experience feeling like no one really cared about the kind of stuff he'd accomplished in the literary world. It's been going on for a long time. And in a way, I think that's kind of cool. I think even in these the more mainstream forms of media, there is there's great, for instance, great television and film, and then there's more mainstream stuff. And the audience size for the stuff that we think of as great is minuscule in comparison to the stuff that's not so great. So I guess only because I've had my nose pressed up against it and I've kind of had my arms around the shoulders of my grad students and undergrads and helped urge them on and put my heart and soul into their work for years, it isn't so shocking to me that they start with almost nothing and get somewhere. You know, but I think the funny thing is that this book plays with is what does it mean to be a big literary star? You don't really have to worry about anybody bothering you when you go to the Rite Aid, you know, to pick up your box of tissues in the middle of the night. No one's going to look over your shoulder and see what kind of prescription you're getting. They're just not that interested in you. They're not going to recognize you anyway. And in a way, that sort of is comforting to me. There's something authentic, I think, about the fact that you can be great at something and not make that much money at it and not really be that famous, but still in some ways apprehend some part of the world.
Well, I would go further even than that and say that there's nothing wrong with writing a very good novel about being demoralized. You know, this is a genuine subject.
Right.
And demoralization, well, occupies just about every rung of life.
Yeah.
And we all are busy searching for what it is we're going to fail at next. You know, if Samuel Beckett is right, he says, fail more, fail better,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And that, in a part, is what makes this book both moving and heartbreaking. Because we do, don't we, Matthew, want to think that a rich woman involved with a billionaire can give us a gift that will save the rest of our lives. And she's not about to.
Well, right. So she's not about to. And she in fact, kind of is fairly conscious of the fact that this guy can barely, he sort of accidentally spent the family's savings. And the savings were going toward paying for his daughter's preschool in the fall. But what she did give him, and I think it's legitimate, is she gave him a connection to his senses, and she brought him back to a feeling of aliveness that he had lost. And it is through this kind of erotic experience the two of them have, but it's also through something else. She opens up to him utterly and completely, and they are in a form, it's a four-day kind of love affair, but they've been writing intensely long and detailed emails and texts to each other for months. And the buildup of that intimacy and then the expression of their, you know, sexual ardor is really moving and powerful. And I think this guy intends to take it with him, even though she hasn't written a blank check and handed it to him. But she's given him herself totally. And she plans to continue to have that relationship and stay open to him forever. And he's burdened by and kind of freaked out at the prospect that he's going to be responsible for keeping her sane while she stays in this 0.003% lifestyle that she's living. But it's also a lifeline in a way to him.
But Matt, it's also that as we go through this book, the characters find it harder and harder to breathe. They're suffocating. They're fearing they're having coronary events. You're laughing. I wasn't.
I guess because I know they're not, and I see.
But you see, throughout, Rich is thinking between one woman and his wife and his child that he doesn't know how to support himself or anyone else anymore, and that this is a hard life to live. More than that, you see, he's visited Amy, the woman he's having an affair with, and he's seen her house, and it nauseates him. It's such a wealthy house. It's such a fancy house. It's so beyond anything he could ever want or lay claim to.
Yeah, he thinks the kitchen island, the island inside the in the kitchen, is bigger than his entire kitchen.
Yes. And that sense, you know, you're laying it out for us. I don't know what kind of a survivor you are of disappointment. But, you know, as you were saying before about capitalism, these writers, people who are hoping to escape capitalism and its dubious rewards. But they see that the only people who get rewards are the capitalists.
We're living in a strange time right now, and that's one of the messages that I think my narrator is, you know, I'm stuck in the book, and he's stuck in, which is this, you know, there's income inequality all over this book. But I think the other point that I'm trying to make, the larger point, there was a letter to the New York Times about the title of my book. He said, this guy said, did you get this from a tractate in the Talmud that says, he who is rich is he who is happy with his lot in life? And in the end, I think that's what this title is about, because the fact is you really wouldn't want to trade places with the billionaire. And this man who is the narrator has in some ways a much happier life. And it brings up the question of happiness. And I think for any of us, what makes for a happy Saturday? You know, a lot of times it's not the fact that you scored the $600 orchestra tickets to Hamilton. It's the fact that you and the people you live with, or you and the weather, or you and the delicious thing you're cooking are somehow in sync, and time doesn't feel like it's crawling. It feels like it's flying by, and you only wish the day would last longer. That's happiness to me. Anyway.
I've been talking with Matthew Clam, author of Who Is Rich, published by Random House. Thank you, Matthew, for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me, Michael.
You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from Who Is Rich at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to my assistant, David Sobel. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
A bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Andrew Sean Greer is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.